Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Russell Shell. I'm the executive director here at the Global Taiwan Institute. GTI is a 501c3 nonprofit think tank dedicated exclusively to Taiwan policy research. We are the only think tank in DC focused exclusively on this issue. And so we are very very pleased to have this biweekly event that we have assembled here today, which is one of our multiple programs that we implement here to include a weekly publication called the Global Taiwan Brief. And I would just like to point out that in the case that you have are not already receiving our publications, I'd like to highlight two in particular, which is issue 11 and issue number 6. Issue 11, we address President-elect Trump's Taiwan policy, where we had two former directors of the American Institute in Taiwan contribute articles to that publication, to that issue. And also issue number 6, which is a assessment of the Taiwan policy review, where we had one of our advisors, Shirley Khan, who is here with us today to address this this topic. And she's, I believe, in the room over there. So that's great. So when we first thought of the idea to, let me take a step back and just acknowledge some of our esteemed guests in the room. And really, they are our board members, our advisory board members, to include our staff. First of all, I'd like to recognize our vice chair, Jennifer Hu, including our advisory board members such as David Tsai and Shirley Khan, and our staff members, Melissa Newcomb, who's our research manager, David An, our senior research fellow, Lily Lin, our office manager, and Annabelle, our program associate. And really, this is that's the backbone of this operation here. And I like to think that we punch above our weight, and we're really fulfilling a demand here in Washington for more information and analysis about Taiwan. And so this is why we have these bi-weekly events, where we try to bring leading experts to address timely topics related to Taiwan policy issues. And so when we first thought about this idea of having a seminar on economic cooperation between the United States and Taiwan, it was really framed in the context of Taiwan's potential participation in the second round of negotiation of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I think Derek kindly reminded me that TPP was already on life support, so since both the Republican and Democratic presidential candidates at the time opposed the trade deal. And certainly on November 22nd, when President-elect Trump said that he would, issue our notification of intent to withdraw from the TPP and replace it with negotiating a fair bilateral trade deal, that sounded like sort of the last nail in the coffin for the TPP. But the TPP is not and should not be the end-all, be-all for economic cooperation between the United States and Taiwan. Just to name a few data points, is that Taiwan is the United States' ninth largest trading partner. This is according to in 2015. Taiwan was the United States' 14th largest goods exports market in 2015, the 11th largest supplier of goods imports in 2015. And according to the Department of Commerce, U.S. exports of goods and services to Taiwan supported an estimated 217,000 jobs in 2014. So I think that these data points point towards a healthy and strong economic relationship, but there's certainly room for it to become better. But obviously the question is how. So, I'm also, this is obviously a very timely event given what I've just said, but I think to even make it more timelier, I'm pleased to note that a U.S. Senior official just visited Taiwan from December 10th to 13th. Ambassador Matthew Matthews, who's the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Australia, New Zealand, and Pacific Islands, and also for APEC, was in Taiwan to exchange some views about the APEC outcomes that just took place in November. And so I think this just really adds to the timeliness of our event here today. So I really cannot think of a better group of experts to really address and unpack really the potentials and the opportunities as well as the challenges ahead. To my immediate left, we have Derek Scissors, who is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. So now I don't know the time. Okay. And he focuses on Chinese and Indian economies and on the U.S. economic relations with Asia. He's concurrently the chief economist of the China Beige Book and the author of the China Global Investment Tracker. To his left, we have Bob Wong, who is a senior associate for with the CSIS. He was a career foreign service officer in the U.S. Department of State from 1984 to 2016. And Mr. Wong last served as U.S. senior official for APEC from 2013 to 15. He was also the deputy director of AIT from 2006 to 2009. Last but not least, we have Rupert Hammond Chambers, who is the president of the U.S.-Taiwan Business Council, where he has focused on developing the council's role as a strategic partner to its members and as a leader in empowering American companies in Asia through value and excellence. He was, Hammond Chambers is also the managing director for Taiwan at Power Group Asia, and a board member of the Project 2049 Institute, where I previously worked. So in keeping with the format of our previous events, where we like to keep this more as a conversation, I prepared a set of questions that I will address to the panelists. And sort of breaking with tradition a little bit, instead of asking specific questions first, I'd like to open up with some more sort of broader questions that I'd like the panelists to address before diving in. And so, I mean, I think the first one, which is, I think, you know, front and center on everyone's on radar screen, is what is your prognosis of for the TPP under Trump's administration? And, you know, maybe just sort of go down the line here and you know, provide that assessment quickly.
So I said this, I think, in public, eventually came out of public. Congressional leadership in March decided they didn't want to vote on TPP. It's not new, it's not a surprise. Text came out in February or November of last year. I read it and wrote about it. We had the media IPC report that didn't change anything. We weren't going to get a TPP vote. Now, if the new president had come in and said, this is a top priority, okay, well, then maybe Congress is going to change its mind. There could be some horse trading. But since both presidential candidates opposed it, it was dead before the election. Dead. And we'd be some ambassadors roaming around saying, we really think President Trump should reevaluate TPP. I mean, sure, that's fine. President Trump has been known to change his mind quickly. I don't think that would actually be a good thing for U.S. trade policy if he suddenly became pro-TPP. It'd be a little difficult to believe in that. So, you know, under Clinton, maybe you could have had a renaming of it and changed some parameters. Trump's not interested. His people aren't interested. So I think there's still noise about this from the Japanese and others. And you can, like I said, why not vote for President? The president-elect completely changed his mind. But this agreement, I think, was actually dead last spring.
Yeah, I'll just add to that and say that it's probably better adjective to be it's in a coma. In my recent trip to Asia, Vietnam, Singapore, and also when I was in Beijing, I talked to the Japanese ambassador there as well. I think that there's certainly great disappointment that the U.S. is withdrawing from TPP, but there is increasing talk about TPP 11. And I reminded them of the Ocean 11, really good movie. is this recorded? I'm sorry. But there's a feeling that since you've done so much work over the past 5-6 years, and you do have a lot of big disciplines in there, that there is talk, I think in Japan in particular, about, although initially it was great disappointment, about possibly moving ahead and perhaps having the U.S. at some point join the second round or something like that. But there is talk of that, so I just want to mention it. Not that it's going to happen, but I think it's at least a possibility.
I suppose I come down on TPP as somebody who takes Mr. Trump at his word. I think TPP is done, and I think that the statements that have come out of Mr. Trump on this issue have been careful to say TPP is done, but we're interested in bilaterals. I also think it's important to look at what he's trying to do with a reorientation of the U.S. political domestic base that voted for him. And for him, the two big things that he really hammered at were immigration and trade. It's just very difficult to conceive, as Derek noted, that he would backtrack on this given the relationship he hopes to build over time with a constituency that views trade with considerable trepidation. So I think TPP has passed, but I am encouraged by the fact that Mr. Trump continues to put free traders in positions of economic positions of importance, and that would speak to some sort of trade liberalization process in our future, but not TPP.
That's great, and I just want to lead off on that. And you know, and both Derek and Rupert, you've hinted at this in terms of, you know, sort of the, what is the sort of the trade direction? What's the sort of the what would Trump's trade policy look like, knowing that, you know, sort of TPP was a President Obama's signature on trade policy? What do you think, you know, will, to the extent that you can, you know, sort of define this, what will Trump's signature trade policy be like? And this is just to go down.
Okay. We don't have a USTR. We don't have somebody who does international treasury and secretary designate is not as a domestic asset trader. So we don't have key personnel to talk about. I agree with Rupert's general point. The president said he's a free trader, he'll fight for free trade. President, whether that's, you know, what that means exactly is unclear, but it's not saying I'm not a free trader. It's not a rejection. So that's positive. We have some people in office, both National Economic Council and Treasury, who have said that they're pro-trade. Of course, Secretary Desmond Ross says he's pro-trade and then immediately says accept. There, we're not in a position to say. I think there will be positive initiatives. They are aware of the need that if you're going to take protectionist steps, that you should couple them with a positive agenda. But we don't have the right personnel to know where the emphasis is. We don't have somebody who has a track record saying, I really think we should do X. I'll finish my comments by saying I have said a couple of things, one of which is relevant, one which turned out to be wrong. If Britain were out of Europe, the best thing for the U.S. to do would be to push an FTA with Britain. It would not take long. We basically already have open trade with the British. It would be a symbolic step. It would actually have economic implications. The problem is, the mistake I made when I called for this originally is the Brexit process is going to take another 18 months. And so the U.S. is just not going to be in a position to start negotiations because we don't know where the baseline is going to be until late 2017. It can't be done right out of the chute. And the other FTA I called for was with Taiwan. And I think politically that's pretty easy. It'll pass the Congress. We still have trade promotion authority. Taiwan's population means there's no jobs threat to the U.S. But of course the actual substance of the negotiation could be quite difficult. There might be some feelers out when we get the right people, whether they see these priorities in Asia, or they want to go to sub-Saharan Africa, where we have no free trade agreements with Latin America, is unclear. If we have someone who's interested in Asia, I think somebody might want to check out what the Taiwanese response would be. Now, the story there, of course, is the U.S. is not going to sign a strategic free trade agreement. It's not going to be for this purpose of political or diplomatic gain, right? The Obama administration tried that. It failed. Trump administration will not try that. There's going to have to be economic benefit in any FTA that's signed, even if it's small. It still has to be positive.
Mm-hmm. Bob?
Sure. I'll just build a little bit on what Rupert and Derek said in terms of Trump's general views on trade. I think it's probably not correct to say that he's anti-globalization, especially if you look at his own practice in terms of his businesses, his daughter's business, etc. He understands that there is a globalization process, that people can trade, that you can get advantages from free trade, from trade in general, not necessarily free trade, from trade in general. So I think it's probably not correct to say he's anti-globalization or anti-trade, but I think it's perhaps better to say, as he said many times, that he's for sort of quote-unquote better trade relations or better trade policies on the part of the United States that's fairer to the United States, for example, when he refers to China or to others. And he, this extends not just to trade, but also to alliances. He's always thinking of what is it we have negotiated, is it good for the United States, can it be better for the United States in terms of who pays for what, where the jobs go, et cetera. So I don't think he's anti-trade per se, but he is more for driving a harder bargain, as he tends to do, with our allies, not just our I'm not sure with enemies, but even with our allies and others, he wants to drive a hard bargain, and I think that's probably true for China. And by the way, if he does agree to doing a free trade agreement with Taiwan, I don't think it'll be an easy agreement. He's going to drive a hard bargain as well. So it goes across the board. I think that's one thing. In terms of signature trade policy, I can't think of anything right now in terms of like TPP or something like that that he would have. I think all we could expect, I think probably correctly, as I said earlier, is a much tougher trade policy in terms of enforcement, in terms of bargaining. He will use all the tools that he has. He will tweet. He will use all the tools he has. He could call carrier, he'll call this or that. He will drive his deal to use his personal leverage. People talked about the Taiwan call as a leverage already. But I expect that would be not a signature, but that would be the characteristic of his trade policy in the next 4 years.
I think I would lead off with Mr. Trump is a populist Republican, and that's certainly the way he's run. We all know this, but I think it's instructive to look at how he was elected and non-coastal America and how they view trade. I expect Trump trade policy to have a degree of protectionism in it. It's going to cause some heartache amongst diehard conservatives in congressional caucuses on Capitol Hill. But I believe that Mr. Trump is going to take the approach where U.S. trade policy is going to have embedded in it a degree of protectionism to improve social cohesion in non-coastal America and to, in his mind anyway, improve the economic future for parts of the country that argue that they have been hollowed out as a function of trade, whether we accept that as a legitimate argument or not.
I just wanted to say one thing that Rupert's comment reminded me of. There is a House bill, there's a House plan that leadership has approved of for reforming U.S. corporate taxes that includes a border adjustment. I spent all of last night in New York cautioning people that just because there's one plan doesn't mean you should only focus on one plan. We need to see somebody in the Trump, who actually has a position, not just a designate, say they like the plan. We need to see if Senate comes up with anything. But in that plan, rather than outright protectionism, but for the same goals that Rupert was discussing, the border adjustment basically taxes imports. And it's similar to a VAT, which the U.S. has never proposed. It's not exactly a VAT because there's a labor exemption, effectively a labor exemption. That would narrow the U.S. trade deficit, which would achieve a political goal. It will raise money, which is why it's attractive to Congress. And because of the labor exemption, it essentially subsidizes, compared to the current situation, it reduces the burden on labor from the payroll tax. That's essentially the outcome. So we're going to get some of those steps if that kind of corporate tax plan is adopted, which means that outright protectionism might not need to be a sweeping for the sake of the goals Rupert's talking about. So I'm agreeing with Rupert in saying, but corporate tax reform could accomplish some of those goals that the Trump administration has. So we'll still get steel and aluminum tariffs on the Chinese or something like that, but we may not need to go as far as some people who voted for Trump would otherwise want if the corporate tax proposal includes a border adjustment.
So now moving to more focused on U.S.-Taiwan economic cooperation, and since both Derek and Bob brought this up as a possibility, Rupert, now the U.S.-Taiwan Business Council has been the forefront of pushing an FTA with Taiwan. What are the benefits for both sides for an FTA? If it makes economic sense, why hasn't there been a Taiwan-U.S. FTA?
China? not to be flippant, but, we were always taught in Sunday school, if you didn't know the answer, just say Jesus. But perhaps that's a play on this. In all seriousness, a free trade agreement between the United States and Taiwan would be a game changer. It would be the sort of expansive, forward-looking, visionary policy that could be part of an overall U.S. approach to Taiwan that would appropriately position Taiwan in a geostrategic sense for the region. as a parochial subset of U.S.-China relations. And that, as you correctly note, Russell, is something that U.S.-Taiwan Business Council has been arguing for some time. We'd see gains in services, agriculture, to name but two. And critically, we'd also, I believe, offer leadership for the rest of the region to follow, providing framework and political cover for the Japanese, the Aussies, and perhaps some of the Southeast Asian nations that aren't too in lockstep with China yet, to engage Taiwan on free trade agreements, or we can use some other brand of nomenclature if that makes it more politically palatable. But nevertheless, it is absolutely something that the U.S.-Taiwan Business Council will be pushing for with Mr. Trump, and we are quite encouraged, actually, by some of the statements that he has made about bilateral free trade agreements and a bilateral approach. And I absolutely associate myself with Derek's comments that Taiwan can and should be at the very top of the list.
Well, you know, I mean, but Derek just said that, you know, that the Trump administration will not sign a strategic free trade agreement. So I mean, there are many countries, I think, that want to sign an FTA with the United States. And so why should Taiwan be at the top of that list then?
Well, I think, again, there is the issue of Taiwan's position within the region. Taiwan is motivated. I get that. You could argue why Taiwan. Taiwan is also motivated to do a free trade agreement and motivated to do a high standard free trade agreement, which could set the standard for other agreements around the region. I think that argument has considerable value. I also think, again, that it requires an attitude adjustment as to the importance of Taiwan within the region and its economic health and well-being, and the fact that it is as worthy as the Koreans or the Indians or any of our major trading partners within the region to do a free trade agreement. So if not Japan or Korea, then why not Taiwan?
Now, shifting gear, Bob, I mean, in your comments that you made last month at the Hudson Institute, which kind of served as one of the inspirations for this this panel, you were one of the first experts that I heard in Washington call for Washington to consider initiating a dialogue with Taiwan on a bilateral investment agreement. For non-trade folks, what is a BIA, and why BIA, and why now?
Sure. Before I answer that question, let me just comment on what Rupert said briefly, and Derek as well, I guess, to some extent. At this point, I really just don't see, in just my own view, I don't see President Trump coming out in the next 1 or 2 years after having campaigned against TPP and everything else and saying suddenly, we now would like to have a free trade agreement with Taiwan or anybody else. Maybe called something else, he might do something else, but it just politically seems to me not something that I would expect anyway. Of course, it wouldn't be the first time I'm surprised by Trump. But I just don't see it politically as something that would be announced in a year or two with whoever. And the second thing is that I think even if he did go down that path, it's going to be a long path. I mean, an FTA is very difficult. It covers labor, environment, everything else besides market access, besides whatever you have. And so I wonder if that really is the right path to go, although theoretically I think it's a good idea to have this strategic FTA with Taiwan or somebody else, but I just don't know whether or not it's something you want to go down the road solely, because it will even if it does come around in a year or two, to want to do something like that, how much longer will it take to actually get something negotiated, especially if he's going to be tough? And if he's really, really tough, then the negotiations will go longer and longer. It could go beyond 4 years, fifth year, sixth year, assuming he's still around then. But the question is this what Taiwan really wants to start down the road on, and that is negotiating something that'll take 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years? I don't think Taiwan has that much time in terms of having to restructure its economy and do all the things that are necessary. So, again, in theory, I think it's a good idea. In practice, I think it's maybe not as realistic from my own perspective. And in some ways, that leads me to the BIA, the Bilateral Investment Agreement. I think this is something more manageable. It doesn't have the word free trade in it to begin with. which is a positive thing for this. I think it's, again, it's, as you know, an FTA, the one chapter of it usually has to do with investment. So it's a small part of it. You can build towards an FTA at some point down the line, but it would be that investment chapter writ large, somewhat larger than just an investment chapter in the FTA. And I think for the U.S., it would sound good because, as you all know, President Trump will probably focus the first year or so on infrastructure, maybe the first 4 years, on infrastructure. Building, rebuilding U.S. infrastructures, you will need investment from abroad. They'll try to bring some money back that had been camped outside the border by American companies using tax policies. But he will want to invite investment to come, foreign investment to come to the United States, especially if it's aimed at certain areas in the States, infrastructure, but also the Rust Belt or things of that nature. So I think politically speaking, it seems to me more, realistic from the point of view of the Trump administration. And for Taiwan, I think equally, and maybe even more important, I think it is very important for Taiwan because as I see it, Taiwan's major challenge now is how to restructure its economy for the future, for the long term. Right now, I think Taiwan's model, it has successfully followed for a long time, I think is gradually hitting a barrier. And IT, sourcing through China, assembly, etc., I think that's been very good so far. But for the last year or two or three years, and coming on the next two or three years, I think, and more, I think there really needs to be restructuring. And I think the new administration does understand that. That's why it's looking at its five innovative industries. It's looking at different kinds of ways to restructure. And in that regard, I think the BIA could be a tool. In other words, sorry to go on for a little bit longer, but yeah, it could be a tool in the sense that if you do a BIA that actually forces Taiwan to really, really structurally improve its investment environment for foreign direct investment, especially in these five areas of biotech, smart machinery, et cetera, silicon, et cetera, and so on, defense. I think in some ways, the restructuring would allow and hopefully promote greater investment in foreign investment in Taiwan. So BIA essentially is a tool where both sides agree that we want to encourage, promote, and protect foreign investment in our, in our area, in our economy. And so from that perspective, I think it can be used as a way to help Taiwan restructure, help Taiwan attract foreign investment. When I was in Taiwan recently, I met with a number of AmCham people. And again, in their white papers, they keep on talking about how Taiwan government can and should improve its investment environment for foreign investment. And there's a long way to go there. And apart from that, I think just two more things. I think the BIA itself will help Taiwan address one of its key problems, which is lack of diversification and over-dependence on one economy across the strait. So if you do a BIA with the United States, and if that is successful in promoting investments from the United States to Taiwan, that in an indirect way does diversify Taiwan's economy. So it doesn't just rely on one source for its economic relations. So I think in that sense, this will help Taiwan diversify as it's trying to do with this new southbound policy, but this may be even more effective because it's coming from advanced developed economies that are investing in Taiwan in some of these industries that will help it grow. And finally, politically, I think it's just in some ways just as important because the more Western companies, not just from the U.S., but from other countries, the more Western companies invest in Taiwan, the more of a stake they have in Taiwan, and the more of a stake their governments have in Taiwan, which I think is a key political goal as well, because you want to increase the stake of other countries, including especially advanced developed countries that are democracies, etc. You want to increase their stake in Taiwan so they feel that they have to sort of strengthen their commitment to Taiwan.
That's great, Bob. And I wanted to pick up on a point that you made about restructuring, and I want to address this question to Derek. And that is that, you know, this isn't the first time Washington talked about Taiwan's need to sort of do economic restructuring. And Derek, can you maybe shed some light on be more specific on why these restrictions, you know, lessening these restrictions are necessary, and the type of economic restructuring that would be more conducive to strengthening a closer U.S.-Taiwan relationship?
I think I'm going to have to split this into two parts, one where I disagree with Bob, and then one where I talk about Taiwan.
It's a bad part.
Right? So I don't actually disagree with, I have a mirror position to Bob's position, which is, I know from conversations, and the conversations mean absolutely nothing because they're occurring in December, and inauguration is in January, but I know from conversations that there are people in the Trump administration who do want to show that the president-elect is serious about bilateral FTAs and free trade. I agree with Bob that may not happen, but that they're not allergic to the idea of free trade. They want to put forward their own version of free trade, and these are better deals, and we're accomplishing more, and it's not this rulemaking, it's actual benefits. So I don't think that there's an immediate allergy to starting right away with an FTA. I'm told there isn't. I completely agree with Bob that this could be a very difficult negotiation, and that has risk to it, partly for the president-elect's attention span. So he may be really excited about this in January, but that's, you know, you better get report some progress quickly. If that isn't possible, then we agree that it's a bad idea. The second part of this is related to that, which is, I don't think a bilateral investment agreement accomplishes much economically. And the U.S. is not interested in a political deal. They're not interested in, we need to do this so Taiwan can break its diplomatic isolation. That's not going to get approval at the top level of the Trump administration. Someone would have to, maybe the new USTR, who we don't know what it is, would come in and say, this is my product, I really want it. Okay, now it's in the ballpark. But it's not something they'd be immediately attracted to. It's not going to attract that much money for infrastructure. Taiwan is already heavily invested in the U.S. It's not like there's $150 billion of Taiwanese capital waiting to build bridges in the United States. So, you know, the flip side of this is, and I think where all of us agree, a good BIA would help Taiwan. That I agree with. And it could help it economically. I'm not going to address the political side. When I talk to, I'm going to offend people in this room, but I think this is just obviously true. I don't do politics, blue, green, I don't care. They all sound exactly the same on trade, right? Which is just ridiculously short-sighted. So Taiwan, the U.S. is having this big debate over globalization. Lots of countries are. I have a position in that debate. But Taiwan can't have a debate. It's 23 million people. It's no resources. Taiwan has to be global. And it has lived off, as Bob just referred to, has lived off Chinese growth. And that growth basically changed both in quality and quantity in 2011. We have not seen an adjustment in Taiwanese policy. So what Taiwan should be doing, and I've written about this and talked about it before, is Taiwan should be taking radical steps to make itself an international financial and economic center, which it can be. It is well positioned for that. The growth areas of the world by terms of young labor force are going to be Philippines, Indonesia, Vietnam, 450 million people, much younger than Northeast Asia. India could also be one, and then North America could be one. But those are your three choices, and one of them is in Southeast Asia. And Taiwan's in a marvelous position mediating Northeast and Southeast Asia and their various comparative advantages. But that requires you to actually be open. You can't just say, oh, well, we love all the benefits from globalization, but competition, no. Poor Taiwanese will be hurt by competition. Okay, fine. Then we'll just sidestep you. And other people will perform the same services. So I do agree with Bob, or I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I think we agree that Taiwan needs a significant shift in its orientation. It's actually years overdue, and if a BIA with the U.S. Would spur that would be great. I don't know about the American interest in this. You really have to be someone who's very interested in Taiwan to take the lead. But I'm just going to give up a specific example, which Rupert and I talked about beforehand. And I'm using this as an illustration. I'm not taking a position on the policy because I don't know enough about it. But what is Taiwan doing targeting Uber? Because they're competing with taxi cabs, okay? Taiwan should be open to competition and services and be an aggressive exporter of services. You don't send the signal of, oh, well, you can't compete with certain services because they're too sensitive here. That's just a bad idea. So I don't know, there may be particular justifications for of that policy, but what I would want, which I have not seen, and if you guys have seen it, please let me know, is a statement from Taiwanese officials saying, look, this is about this particular industry, or the Ministry of Transportation is throwing a tantrum, or whatever it is. It is not a statement on Taiwan's position on services competition, because that really would hurt. It would hurt a BIA, it would hurt an FTA, it would hurt Taiwan's position globally, it would hurt reduce everyone's incentive to negotiate with the Taiwanese. Why take on mainland Chinese criticism if the Taiwanese aren't committed to actual liberalization? So we can go into the sector details if you like. I am not an expert at all on Taiwanese politics, so it's fine for people to say, well, that's not really realistic. You're liberalizing the power sector, you can't do that. Okay, you can't have 10 exceptions. You can have, this is too politically sensitive, but we want to move forward. And so my main point is, you know, what we need from Taiwan is some recognition that hiving off of Chinese growth is done, and Taiwan needs a new approach. We have a new government, they need to have a new approach, and it should not be based on, we want recognition, it should be based on what is Taiwan's role in the global economy. It's inescapable that Taiwan is going to be prosperous.